When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Motorsport Podcast in association with Mercedes-Benz.
What do you think of when someone says the word used? Old-fashioned? Out of tune? A bit scratched? Something past its best? Chances are you're not thinking of a Mercedes-Benz. And certainly not one of the latest models. Think Mercedes-Benz approved used. Suddenly, there's a lot more meaning to that little word. Visit your local retailer to find your used car today, and you'll see what I mean. I like the way you work it. Mercedes-Benz approved used. Used, but not what you're used to.
I'm Ed Foster, and I'm the online editor of Motorsport, and I'm joined by features editor Simon Aaron, editor Nick Trott, and our special guest, Paul Stewart. Thank you so much for joining us today and coming all the way to Finchley to come and chat.
Thank you for having me.
We obviously also have Alan Hyde behind the audio equipment. Alan, thank you very much as always. I know that you were filming the Queen last week, so it's not quite such an occasion as that, but hopefully we won't disappoint too much. Now, Paul, if I'm not mistaken, you're about to go off and have some lunch with Andrew Frankel after this for the lunch with feature in the magazine. Is that right?
I believe so. He emailed me, and actually it was through the BRDC, oddly enough. I'm surprised that was an interesting way to get to me, but it was nice that you got in contact. So I'll be seeing him afterwards.
So we have loads of readers' questions. So we will come to those in a bit, ranging from questions about Stewart Grand Prix to, well, loads of topics, which is great. What I wanted to do was rewind right back to the start, and Simon mentioned that you might have borrowed a friend's driving license in order to go and do a race course. Is that correct? And also faked your name as well.
Yeah. Well, it was the first time I had a sort of burning desire, which, you know, call it the bug, was I was 17, and I'd been the British Grand Prix, and I had just got my driver's license, and up until then, whenever I was with my father in particular, you know, and you were at Monaco Grand Prix as a kid or something in the elevator, the obvious thing somebody would do is, you know, rather than engage my father, they would look down at me and say, you know, you're going to become a racing driver. And I would always look up and say, oh, not again, no. and I always said that. And then I had this experience at British Grand Prix. I thought, this is interesting. I'd like, you know, maybe, you know, more of this. And so I approached my father. I had got all the information on racing schools. At that time, it was to do it at Snetterton with the Jim Russell School. And I had all the information set up. We were living in Switzerland at the time. And I had, right now, I've got to go and tell them what I want to do this. And I still remember the whole, you know, the moment, and it was a really difficult thing to bring up. Bearing in mind that my father, I knew, would never want me to become a racing driver. Unlike, you know, many young drivers that come through karting, I knew he was vehemently against it. And really because so many of his friends had got killed. And so it was understandable. And anyway, I said, look, so I want to do this racing school thing. And he was so let down. You know, it was like, but I said, I've got to say it, you know. And it took quite a lot of courage, bizarrely. And the bottom line is, we said, well, let's go in through. We talk about it in my office in the house, and I remember going into the to his office at the time, and straight ahead of me was a picture of Joe Siffert, and he goes, "There's another one," you know, and he's just processing all of this. And actually, I was at the race where Joe Siffert was killed, and that's one of the memories I have as a young boy. There's a whole, I remember these different things with drivers having getting killed. And anyway, we sat down, and he talked me out of it. So then he said, "Look, if you go to university and you still want to do it, then I'll look at helping you out and seeing how we can, you know, do it." But he was adamant that if I do it now, you're on your own. Now, I'm living in Switzerland. I ain't got the money. There was no chance of me becoming a racing driver.
It was a bit short of racetracks as well, Switzerland.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, the mountain roads are pretty good, but yeah, that's another story. And so when I did go racing, I went to the racing school at Brands Hatch, and before I signed up for it, I said, "I want to do it." He didn't set it up. I said, "I'm going, I want to do this thing." And he said, "Well," and it was Stuart Turner, he said, "We should do it under an assumed name." He was at Ford Motorsports at the time, and had helped be part of my father's career. And so I borrowed my friend's driver's license. Robin Congdon was his name, which raised a few chuckles. And I sort of, you know, poor Robin, because he's a good mate, and I sort of felt that sometimes people made fun of him. And but that was it, under an assumed name. And it was just so that I could be, I could do it without anyone saying, "Oh, yeah, he's got potential, here's Jackie's boy," all that kind of stuff. And it was good advice, and it was a good thing. Yeah, helped me.
So going back to the moment where you realised you had this drive to be a racing driver, did that come from messing around at home on dirt bikes, or was it the element of competition that you really craved at that point? That there was obviously a trigger somewhere where you thought, I have to do this.
Well, I've always been very competitive in terms of sports and things. Team sports, not so good, but things like cross-country running, you know, I used to do a lot of that, and skiing. We had some motorcycles. My father and mother bought my brother and I two little motorcycles one day, and it was out of the blue. Again, he didn't want us, everyone in Switzerland about my age had mopeds, so they could all have a bit of freedom and go and see their mates and go into town. But there was associated dangers with being on the roads as a 14-year-old back then. It was when we were allowed to have it. And I got out of the blue. It wasn't even Christmas. These two motorcycles were there, a little one for my brother and a slightly big one for myself. And but it was for dirt roads, you know, for dirt, you know, around the field and stuff. And so I drove that thing into the ground. I mean, there wasn't a corner I didn't take, which I didn't sort of felt like extracted as much as I could out of it, no matter what it was, around a tree, or there's nothing slow about it. So yeah, and I've always been, I like speed. And I just didn't realize the connection between that and more, you know, and wanting to become a racing driver, because it was that sort of obstacle, if you like, parental obstacle for understandable reasons. But then when it sort of clicked and I got it, it was a relief in some ways, you know. Yeah,
but you couldn't shake it.
Well, I there's no way of me being dulled. I just, you know, I had no idea. So when I was at university, and it was my last summer off, I'd worked in banks and God knows what, you know, New York and London and Geneva, and I'd sort of figure out, is this what it is when I, you know, leave, you know, or whatever that version of. And I said, well, this summer, it was the summer before I started what they call my senior year. It's a 4-year course in America. And it was my last summer off. I'm going to do something. I've got to roll a dice here. And one of the things I looked at doing was working on an oil rig in Alaska. I said, I'll never do it any time in my life, but I had this fixation, I want to do it. And then, but the other thing was, if I could, you know, by some miracle, do some racing. Having done that little short racing course, it was a spring break while everyone else was down at the beach and having fun during this American spring break. I was doing the course at Brands Hatch, came back from that and said, I know I want to see if we can put a summer program together. And at the time, people were starting to help out, actually. There was some, I started getting some deals because I had some friends that I knew then, and they said, oh, we could do this, we could do that. And I mean, all sorts, you know, Cellnet were quite heavily involved in the sport at the time with Damon. And that was one of the potential possibilities of putting a program together. And I was on my own on that at that point. And my father, we've always had a close relationship. But for those who know him, he likes to have input. And he was feeling a bit left out at that point, I think. And he said, okay, right. And he didn't want these people helping his son out in motorsports. And he didn't say as much, but that's basically how was the sort of the seed that created the relationship that we had together, which ultimately was led on to Paul Stewart Racing and everything else.
Can I ask, when, obviously, you know, when you very first started, you went under your friend's name, but when you did start racing, how much of a burden was the surname? Because, I mean, I suppose you obviously grew up and you didn't know anything else, and you had people coming up in lifts saying, oh, you're going to be a racer, so you knew quite about it, but was it still quite a heavy weight on your shoulders?
First of all, I didn't know any different, and I think a lot of young drivers would have given their right hand to be in my position, so I got that too. So I figured there's a little bit of, you know, if there was a little bit of negative media around maybe, you know, having an accident or something of that kind, and maybe even I knew people might be thinking, oh, who's this upstart coming in? He hasn't done karting, he hasn't done this and that, and here he is slotting in to at that time the Junior Formula 4 Championship Townsend Torsen Series. And but, you know, I just had to get on with it. You've got to be thick-skinned, and Simon will no doubt remember more about that pier than I will, possibly.
I remember quite. The first time I met you was actually in the cafeteria at Alton Park. I do remember that. Late 86, beginning of 87.
In 87 was when I was racing Formula Ford. Yeah. I had 3 months during my summer break in America. So then went back to university. So that would have been up at Alton Park in 87. That was my first year. Glad we got the date tied down.
It doesn't surprise me that Simon knew exactly.
Did I behave
when,
myself,
where?
Simon?
Yeah, reasonably. Yeah, you seem like a very well adjusted young lad. I thought, yeah, no, you came across well.
I'm kicking him under the table, by the way.
Well, that's a relief. Otherwise, the next 45 minutes can be quite awkward. So you mentioned Paul Stewart Racing because that you started in 88. How did that come about, and why did it start?
Well, I was racing with Van Diemen, and they had put a little sort of junior team, little team up for me. The senior championship, which Eddie Irvine was racing in. Paolo Carcassi was doing the Formula 4 2000. There's a couple of other Brazilians up there, and I sort of worked out that having done the junior championship, I needed to go into I wanted to go up the following year, if possible, and. Rather than do the senior championship, I can't remember what was going on then. I really didn't have enough experience, but the Formula 4 championship was potentially looking like a good way of developing. It wasn't going to be as strong as a year before that when you had Leto and all those guys. And I'd gone to see some of the teams. I saw, you know, Keith Wiggins, all these guys. I went round and saw them. Well, how much would it cost to come and, you know, what do you need? You know, do you have budgets? Not. So I worked out all the numbers. And then I can't remember who it was that said it, but I was, you know, thought maybe it could be done myself. It would possibly Adrian Reynard trying to sell me cars. And
almost certainly Adrian Reynard trying to sell me cars, I thought. Yeah.
And so we looked at that possibility. And It made sense to me because it at that level you don't need to get too many people. I could, and I'd also had worked out. I was fortunate. I went to the Mexican Grand Prix in '86, and I met Duncan Lee from Camel, and we're on the plane heading down there, and he was in charge of the sponsorship for motorsports, I got on well with him, and then I got word and I didn't say anything to him at that point because I was still at university, and I got word that they might be interested in doing something because they were looking at you know, at, helpful being a son of a former One driver, and they had a few other. They were doing Paul Warwick.
David Braben, David, Damon, yeah, and people, yeah.
And so I got in touch with them, and they were interested. And then I my father and I were working together on that at that point. And I can't remember what it would have been after that, but it was just like, look, we're going to start this thing, and then what do we need? We just need. You know, we had Roy Topp as a mechanic and two other people, and that was, you know, that was it. We got going, and they provided, and we said, well, this is what the budget would be. Are you interested? He said, yeah, we'll do it. So it was a pretty good way. When we knew for that, we could make it work, and then we got a few other sponsors to come in that sort of allowed us a bit more flexibility to do the things we wanted to do it properly.
Were you also keen to step up straight from Junior Ford, formerly Ford 1600, to 2000, because you started quite late in the sport relative to some of the other guys around you?
I felt I had to do some catching up, and for sure I was 21 in 87, and so here I am, and the only reason I was doing it was to become a Formula One driver. I mean, I wasn't doing it to have a play, you know. I was serious about it, and I was, you know, committed and driven. You know, one could question and say, well, the team side, you know, is that, you know, should I just concentrate the driving? And, you know, I'd been through university. I knew it was a risk, and I didn't want to be sort of left out in the cold, having sort of wasted valuable years of my life. And I was ambitious. So it made sense to have the team and to do it in Formula Ford 2000, you said, to get closer to Formula 3, and bit better prepared for when that time was right to do that.
What I wanted to do was just rewind you to Snetterton in 1989.
You haven't mentioned Cadwell Park Formula 4 2000 win yet.
What did I do at Cadwell Park Formula 2000? Remind me of that one. What did I do?
Yeah, that was your first race win.
What was that?
Your first race win.
Oh, Cadwell, yeah, of course it was. Yeah, so I was thinking Alton for a second there. Yeah, Cadwell Park, absolutely. You know, I mean, thank you, Simon.
I mean, of all the places to break your duck.
Exactly. Well, yeah. Cadwell Park was for those who haven't been to Cadwell Park, it's not many people have. I'm assuming, Simon,
yeah, you've been.
It's a fantastic circuit, a driver's circuit, ups and downs and all the rest of it, and jumps and things. And... it was a key win, actually, if it's relevant to this to what you're asking me, because I'd had one race there, and I didn't do well in it, and I was kind of pissed off as well before that, because I was traipsing around the country with a van, driving this camel van with my racing car in the back of it. I mean, doing promotions for the Carphone Group at that time, and I'd leave. Our workshop down at that time was in Stockbridge in Hampshire, and you know, drive up to Edinburgh, to Newcastle, you know, up and then head back down, you know, to Alton for a test, or and then meet up with Roy Topp, who had another car, because we had two cars, which was kind of one of the luxury that we had in case there was a problem or whatever. And anyway, I went down to Cadwell Park, and I would before that been really sort of, this is, I can't do this. Something's got to give. I can't, you know, run all day doing these trips and get down, wake up in the morning, do a test and so on. And there was a moment when I was speaking to my father, and I remember in the van by myself, and I was, you know, I hadn't had a good race, and I said, look, this is not working. You know, I can't do both. I'm, you know, under enormous pressure. And anyway, he talked me back into it again. I should stop getting his advice. I love my father. But he's sort of, and I could, and I understood, you know, I could put my emotions aside, but, you know, but the bottom line is, he said, look, you know, if we could really build up a good company here, if we sort of just stick to it and all the rest of it. And bear in mind, I was the guy that was on the ground here doing it all at the time. So it was a great learning experience, and it was things that I should be doing at that age, you know. But I went back to Cadwell Park, having not done well in the first race there, and I drove up and I arranged with, I think it was Graham Glue, to take me round the track during the lunch break for a couple of laps, or at the end of the day. And it's a hell of a drive up there. And I left from Southampton, went up And it was, we must have done 4 or 5 laps, and it was all it took, and something I picked up on, and I went there for the next race, and I won it. And that same weekend was the weekend that Camel had won the Italian Grand Prix when Senna was taken out by the Williams, and the chicane, and Prost had had his retirement. So I guess I must have had Camel on the car, and I won my race. And somebody had said to me, if you win one race a season, you've got your budget for Formula 3 next year. And I was, you know, and I thought, ooh, that, you know, so it was pretty, it was a timely thing. And that's what led us to, you know, part of the ingredients. I'm not trying to claim everything here, but it was part of the mix, that sort of catalyst.
And did someone then say to you, if you win a race at Snetterton by crossing the line backwards, you've got your budget for the year after that?
No, Simon, you're taking advantage of it. Something. Remember that dyslexia rules KO, you know, getting things the wrong way around is part of being dyslexic. And yeah, well, that was another experience altogether. And it was, I'd started, so the that was, and stop me if I'm going on too long here, because I'd done 3 months of Formula Ford, 1600, went back to university, got my degree, came back in and started racing in Formula Ford in June of 88. So finished off that season, having done nothing in between. And then here I was now going into Formula 3 in the beginning of 89 against, you know, Rickard Riedel, Hakkinen, McNish,
Brabham.
Brabham. There was a whole bunch of tough drivers. And at that time, there was two grid. You know, you had to qualify to get in the main race too. So they called it, you know, the wanker race. If you didn't set a good time in qualifying, you were in the excuse me, can I say the wanker race? That's what they all called it. You know, I'm not putting any judgment on it. And there was a couple of occasions I was in that. But you know, here I was learning against, you know, arguably the best championship and one of the best Formula 3 championships. And anyway, I had some bad races, and but I was learning. And then Snetterton that year, beginning to show, break in there a little bit amongst the mix. And then, I guess we qualified third. They had two grids. I think I must have qualified first or second in my session. Maybe it was second. But they used to qualify one side of the grid and the other. And they'd deem that my side must have been the slower session, sorry, the quicker session, because I couldn't be up there with some of the more respected drivers. And it might be dangerous to have it up there. I think that might have been something like Dick Bennett's that sort of argued that case in front of Stewart, who's representing the West Surrey and McNish and so on. And so the race started. Ironically, these two guys stalled on the start. And I led away. And then anyway, I was leading the race. I thought, shit, what do I do now? You know, this is pretty. And I'm not first lap coming through. You've got Coram, there's a long corner, and then you got Russell chicane. For those who remember that, with a fast chicane back then, where if you got it wrong, it's big accidents. And I still remember that first lap run. I said, I'm not lifting through here. I had Higgins behind me. And I'm not going to lift on my first lap around here. You'd normally try to bed yourself in slightly, but anyway, kept my lead. And then I, God knows what lap it was on, but it wasn't that heavily into the race. And I came across a back marker where I could see him ahead of me, and I was going to catch him outside of this very fast chicane. And I said, I'm not lifting. I'm not. If I lift now, Higgins is going to pass me, reading up the next corner. So I kept my foot in. And I still remember, it was Dominic Chappelle, the guy that was involved in all this.
BBHS and stuff, yeah.
Yeah. And Dominic Chappelle in a Class B, I was lapping. And I remember his car moved as I came out the chicane, but it moved because he put his hand up to try and point where to go, but his steering wheel moved in that process. So I thought he went to the inside, and I committed, and he didn't. He wanted me to go the other way around, and so I was committed to the grass, spun, and then try to keep it straight, bear in mind it's quick, and end up spinning across the line. But at the same time, Mika Hakkinen had a big accident. The car was upside down, and so they red flagged it. And I still kept on going, by the way, but I wasn't in the lead. And then they red flagged it, and because they took from the previous lap, I won it. Thumbs up to that one.
What a way to win a race. The recall amazes me, you know, with racing drivers. My recall is rubbish, but just the detail.
I wish I could remember my classes the same way that you remember being in a racing car.
So Paul Stewart Racing then stepped up to Formula 3000, and you were with Marco Apicella then. What are your memories of him? And because he's a very quick driver.
Well, he was one of my teammates. That was my first, I guess, in the first year of Formula 3000. By the way, I need to sort of at least one memorable year to finish off in 89 was Macau. Were you in Macau that year in 89?
I wasn't, no.
So I got an entry.
Probably.
I got an entry to Macau, which at that time was still the big race for young drivers, and it was a little bit questionable. You know, did I deserve to be there? Because I hadn't won a championship, but I'd won won a race. So that, but I guess they wanted me in Camel sponsors and the whole name thing. But I'd never been to that race, and I qualified third. You know, ahead of Schumacher, all those guys, and it was a proud moment actually. Unfortunately, my car broke down. I was in second place at the time. Schumacher had passed me. I'd never heard of this guy. And I could still see this guy in the mirrors around the back section. And I'll take a wide entrance this place because he can't pass me there and I get a clean exit out. I mean, I didn't give very much, but this driver went in like a hammer. And it was, as he passed me, I thought, bloody hell, this guy is good. it was Michael. It was a proud moment, actually, because I shouldn't have been leading a race in Macau at that point in my career. And then to get back to your question, to Formula 3000, Apicella, he was very experienced. I always picked teammates that I thought were going to do the best for the team, not something that I thought was going to be that I would have a better chance of beating or looking good in front of. And you know, the same applied for Formula 3, Derek Higgins, or for my second year of F3. Then you had Otto Rensing, obviously, who had actually won the races in Macau 1 year. And so we always picked the right drivers. And Apicella was one of those guys. He seemed talented. And unfortunately, the Lola car was a disaster that year. And I was trying to learn a formula with a car that basically didn't work as well as a Reynard by a long way. And it was challenging, and even Marco gave up on occasions.
I just checked the stats the other day because I could. I mean, Marco to me is one of the sport's kind of curious lost talents because he was clearly blindingly quick, very very good, and yet very unlucky a lot of the time. I know he won the Japanese 3000 championship eventually, but he finished fifth in the championship in 91. I was trying to think, how the hell did he do that in the Lola T91? Because it was a rubbish car.
I don't know how he did it. And why I didn't go on, I'm not quite sure. I know in a couple of races, you know, he probably didn't, when he knew he wasn't in a chance at the points, he didn't try as hard as he would normally do. And I don't know if that sort of reflected in somehow in his future ambitions of racing. I'm not sure, you know. But he was a good guy, and I got on well with him. And I enjoyed having a teammate that was stronger than me. I could learn off them. But I've lost touch with him actually, so I don't know what he's up to these days. But I don't know, you know, even know what his career did after that. But very nice, and a very nice family. They were always very good to us, and you know, would welcome us to lunch at their house where we're testing a Mugello or something like that and load us with pastas and God knows what.
Around this time, obviously, your ambition is developing. You're starting to recognise where your skill is going to take you as a driver. Was your ambition to reach Formula One or to be a Formula One world champion at this stage? Sometimes it's a different thing.
Always to be a Formula One world champion, and no other reason for me to get there. I did not want to be just getting into Formula One for the sake of it, and that's why I came to the decision ultimately that I did. When after five full seasons of racing and two half seasons of when I was at university. And, I said, well, if I carry on my racing, can I be a world champion or not? I'd raced 3 years in Formula 3000. Admittedly, the first year, maybe not the best chassis. But, you know, I hadn't won a race. I hadn't had sparkling results. I had a podium finish at Po 1 year, which I was still very proud of.
A bit of an incident on the podium in Po, I seem to remember.
Well, that was it was a bit embarrassing situation. That's right, quite right. You got a good recall on that one. Well, I got out the car and I was really thirsty. It's an hour and a half race or something like that in the streets. It was hot, and Alan Mabin at that time, my account, handed me. I got out the car. I was all proud. The only drink he had around was Barzine Brew, and that was one of our sponsors, by the way, Barzine Brew. And so I had, you know, I was hot. I was somewhat dehydrated, and I just took the bar, and I almost could feel this thing sort of, you know, like a frying pan inside my stomach, just sort of congealed, and this sort of lump of mass sort of left behind. And I wasn't feeling very well, and I got on the podium, and I was sick, and the poor people, you know, were kind of trying to distance themselves.
Well, wasn't your dad about to hand you the trophy as well? Was he not up there? I can't remember.
I don't remember that.
No, maybe I got that bit wrong. I remember the throwing up bit.
Yeah, yeah. I don't remember him handing the trophy. I admit that's possible. Maybe I was just trying to recover at that point. I think it was. So it was David was on the podium as well, DC. And it was Pedro Lamy, that's right, yeah.
And well, in 93, that same year, you also tested the Footwork F1 car. How was that test? Because obviously your rate of progression had been very quick up until then. Formula 3000, a big step from F3. It must have been another huge step, having not sort of done as much racing as the others.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was Jackie Oliver called me up and said, do you want to shake the car down at Silverstone? At that point, I was still intent on becoming a Formula One driver. And during the season, I thought, absolutely, what time? I'll be there. And it was a good car that year as well. It was full active ride and everything else. And so I did the shakedown and then loved it. And I drove it three times, I think, in total. I did another shakedown test and another test with all the drivers out the track, and I think I seem to recall doing a respectable time. I think it was quicker than Verstappen at the time, but he had. But I don't recall more.
Well,
than that.
What I recall particularly about that is that the race after the test, you dragging me into the Paul Stewart motorhome and sitting down and complaining about the UK press bigging up Jos Verstappen, when you and a couple of the other guys, when you compared like with like, had done at least as good a job, and you were. Yeah, it wasn't me that had written anything, but one of the magazines, which might be a weekly and begins with an A, had put Verstappen on the front cover, and I remember you were very indignant about that.
That's well. I'm glad I was being feisty about it. I'm glad.
But I don't know why you picked on me to have a rant at, because it had nothing to do with me. But
a sounding board, maybe. I'm glad as a sounding board. Then I was, you know, I knew you'd tell me as it is if you'd ping it back. I'm sure. But I I must have been heated about it, to be honest with you. I'd forgotten I'd been that sort of competitive about it. But I was still wanting to become a Formula One driver, and I believed I could do it. You know, until I felt, look, what's, you know, realistically, and that's when I, at the end of that season, it's coincidental that I got married at the end of that year, but that wasn't a factor in it. It was just, I just stepped away and I thought about it, and I thought, you know, I only want to do this to be, if I've got a potential for being a Formula One driver. And I thought, well, you know, if I haven't ticked the boxes yet, why would it, not that it would be impossible, you know, I mean, Damon did it, you know, and that was sheer determination that got him there, and, you know, total respect to him. I'm not saying I could have done the same job as he'd done, but you know, it would have been possible. But I felt that Paul Stewart Racing at that time had the potential of growing into something more substantial that would play an important part of my life, and would be, you know, it was a trade-off, but it'd be stimulating, and it would allow me to live out some of my dreams. You know, so that was the pendulum decision, and I made that at the end of the season. And I mean, I was driving well at the end of the season. I remember doing a test for Lola up at Silverstone, you know, and it was a Reynard Lola back to back, and, you know, I mean, I was doing times that were incredibly quick, and I was stepping into one car doing a time. I mean, you know, much faster than pole position colder conditions, but they were very competitive. Into the car, boom, I had such confidence. But, you know, I was just rational about it. And I thought, you know, I had a vision for the long term, and I saw this as being something. I didn't think Paul Stewart Racing could carry on if I went into Formula One as a driver. And, you know, my father and I had to be working together to make that happen, and to think, well, I could have been a Formula One driver, and then my father worrying about stuff, it wouldn't have. I know he didn't want that, and it would have been the wrong way of going about it.
Did you get cold turkey from being a driver, or did you not have the time to have a cold turkey, a withdrawal from the buzz of driving a racing car?
You know, I was really good. I didn't have a problem with it at all. I felt when I made that decision, I'd made the decision, and it was in my control. It wasn't being forced upon me, so it hadn't been taken, something being taken away from me. Because I could have very well gone in and driven Paul Stewart Racing, or potentially gone into Formula One that following year, because I had been to Minardi, I'd been to Bologna, done the whole thing with them. They were trying to get me to go there, and you know, Jackie Oliver hadn't said no to me, and it was, you know, it was contingent on me bringing in a budget, which seems incredibly small nowadays when you think back of it, but it was achievable. So no, I didn't. I was good with it. I never felt like I'd missed out. But also, I'd grown up with knowing that my father had stopped racing on his own terms. Albeit his teammate got killed in his last race, but Francois Xavier. But so I knew that you know, it was a good thing to stop, decide when you're in control of it.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to come on to Stewart Grand Prix in a second, and lots of the readers' questions, but I just wanted to mention the offer from Mercedes this month, which is a 25% discount off the AMG Basic Training half-day course, which is a track driving experience with expert tuition. It's something that I could probably do with after my ham-fisted attempts at Blyton last week. Experience can be booked and is completed, but it has to be done before May the 31st. Just call Mercedes-Benz World on 0370 400 4000, and quote the offer code AMG25. There's loads of stuff that you do: the slalom handling, obstacle avoidance, oversteer, understeer. Again, very would have been very useful before the Blyton test last week. So that's the offer code AMG25, and the number is 0370 400 4000, or you can go to mercedes-benzworld.co.uk. It's an amazing place, so it's absolutely worth going to have a look at that. So the Stewart Grand Prix, when did that decision get made, and why was it? Because it was obviously a huge step up. What was the trigger?
Well, I told my father we're in Florida. Actually, we're doing some work with Ford Motor Company. With some vehicle dynamic engineers in Naples, Florida. They got a track down there. And it was at a dinner that one of the nights that we were there, I told him that I made a decision about stopping racing. And he did not push me at all, by the way. This was completely out of the blue for him. And I said, look, I've thought about it. This is the decision I've come to. And I said, but, you know, I want to develop Paul Stewart Racing into something more substantial. And I, at the time, there was different possibilities. I saw British touring cars, German DTM, Indy cars, or the dream being Formula One. To be honest, the Formula One thing was just you know, you had to have it, but I didn't think it was going to be realistic, you know, but it was still the things that we were considering. And so that next, you know, from then on, that would have been, so that was end of 93, so 94 and to some degree 95, much of 95, was really spent going to races. I went to Long Beach, you know, I looked at the whole thing, the franchise system, what you put up, DTM, I did all that, you know, and worked at the budgets, British touring cars as well. And I guess the two we really pursued more, the British Touring Car Championship seemed to be an interesting one because it was on a doorstep and easiest for us to manage. And so we had all the things going. We had a collaboration with Adrian Raynard at the time on it, and we put together a good proposal. And really, then my father was on a flight to Detroit or from the Canadian Grand Prix, and Ford were unhappy with what they were doing. And at that time with whether their efforts in Formula One, and said, and he was talking about, he said, well, if you're interested, put a proposal in, you know, do a proposal to do Formula One. So out of that, I got my head buckled down and put a team together, and we put a proposal to Ford Motor Company, Rob Armstrong and myself, and really, I contacted Martin Sorrell, who's, you know, big in media and WPP, and asked for his guidance, because he was doing a lot of work with Ford, as agencies were, and so he put me in touch with his agency in Detroit, and said, look, they can help you put it together and structure it in the Ford language. And you know, we went back and forwards, did the whole thing with them, and then submitted it. You know, it's just putting all the numbers, working out the budgets. David Stubbs was involved, putting the numbers in and all that kind of stuff. So it was a good little team. And then we submitted it, and they came back and said, we want to do it. And so that would have been, by this point, we were sort of getting towards the end of 95. Yeah, at the end of 95. And I think that's, yeah, it would have been. And then, so they said, yeah, we're on. And that was it. That was the start of it. So we got, the confirmation that we did. We got turned down to the British Touring Car Championship. and I won't see who it is, but we got turned down because of, they thought, we're a bit concerned about the Vauxhall Lotuses in your garage being the racing team, you know, and all that kind of stuff, and a Formula One, you know, so we'd rather not do the touring car operation, do it with somebody else. I thought it was a feeble excuse. But the same day we got the confirmation, we got the Formula One deal. I thought, well, fair enough. You know, but it's different people.
Yeah. Well, it must have been quite daunting, even after that sort of, you know, that faith from Ford to step up to Formula One. I mean, it's such a competitive environment. All motor racing is to a certain extent competitive, but Formula One, you know, is known as the piranha pool. Were you at all concerned? I mean, you know, bearing in mind that fifth race, you've finished second. I mean, it must have been quite an incredible journey.
Well, you know, basically, you're just ignorant and you're brave and you just got to go ahead. You know, I was ambitious, and you don't worry about these things, and thick-skinned, and you think, well, I've got a year to set up a Formula One team. You just got to get it done. You don't think, I can't do it. You know, it's get it done or not do it at all. So it never, never occurred to me that I'm getting into some nasty bits of work here. And I mean, actually, the clever thing that we did was we went about it, and no one actually knew about it, that we got the deal from Ford. I mean, not even Bernie did, because I remember we got a whole bunch of coverage, and you know, you always know when Bernie sort of is interested or something. And I walked into a restaurant in London, and he was there. And he was like, you know, and normally he'd just ignore me. And I'm like, but no one knew about it. And so it was, you know, the Piranha Club thing is, fortunately, I'd known people for many years already, because I'd grown up with it. And people like Ron Dennis, I respected highly, and so on, and you know, Frank, and obviously Ken Tyrrell, you know, is a family member, really, Ken. So there were certain elements there which I felt I could talk to people and, you know, trust what they were saying, or they wouldn't deliberately try and put me off course. So, but yeah, no, ignorance is bless, really, and fortunately, get people in that shared the vision and knew it could be done.
As I said, I do recall I came up to it had been your Formula 3 workshop. It became the Stewart Grand Prix base, and it's now the Red Bull factory. It's still the same place. But I came up there in 96 as it was all coming together. You invited Mark Skewsnight there for lunch, and you guiding us around the place. I mean, I'd never seen anyone quite so full of enthusiasm for it. It was lovely. I mean, but just to see this thing coming up, your passion for the whole thing. I mean, it really, Mark and I left up he really is up for this, isn't he? I mean, it was fantastic to see.
Well, I'm glad I left that impression again. You probably go, this guy's never going to do it, but I'm glad he's got the enthusiasm. You know,
at least he's keen.
So by that point, we were doing that. We had in '96 is when we were creating the team. I was hiring all the people.
Gary Anderson was already with you, and quite a few other people.
Gary didn't join us. Alan Jenkins.
And various other people were there, and all the CAD stuff was installed. You wouldn't let us see the drawings, but all the CAD stuff was installed. Yeah, it was a functioning racing team.
Yeah, the design office was in the truck bay of we basically kicked the trucks outside and that became the design office. Alan was one of the first hires, and I knew I needed to have a technical guy that I respected. Alan had done a very good job that year and the year before with the Arrows, which I drove at Silverstone. They were struggling as a team, I think, financially at the time. And I called Alan up and I said, are you interested? And he goes, yeah, I'm interested. So we had a conversation. We struck a deal very quickly. And that was a key, because the fact that they were also just down the road in Bletchley, or, it's technically Milton Keynes. He just had to sort of, instead of taking a right at the roundabout, he took a left and he got to us. But yeah, it was a very simple setup back then, but we got it done. Yeah.
Now, I keep mentioning these readers' questions. I really should take some. I've got one to hear from Bob Spry. Hi, Paul. I hope this finds you well. Was Jan Magnussen really as lazy as they say? Could he have done more to realise the potential your dad saw in him? Obviously, he drove for Stewart Grand Prix the first 2 years.
Yeah.
Jan Magnussen.
Well, my first meeting with Jan was my father and I. We met him at Heathrow Airport, and he had sort of cleaned up that year in the championship he was doing. And we met up one of the airport hotels. And, he showed up with jeans, T-shirt, jean jacket. Not the best way to impress my father in this instance, but his thankfully for him, his record spoke for itself. And he came and drove for Formula 3 for us. He was just so relaxed and easygoing. I mean, he had an aura about him that year that was there was magic dust on him, really, and he just was so confident. And whatever it was frustrating, because he was there was a sort of a communication enthusiasm that was he wasn't easy to sort of to get along with. But a lot of guys that are really good aren't, and so I respected that still, because he could deliver in the car. He smoked, and that was never a great thing as a young race driver to sort of be. But he was winning races. But I still saw the potential in him in the right environment, and he was ambitious. But at the end, he didn't have enough of a work ethic that was going to, the talent alone is going to get you a certain position, but then it's the work ethic and really, it's not just fitness, but it's just working with the engineers and beyond, with your track engineer. And I think Jan maybe didn't make the most of that opportunity. I'm sure he was frustrated by certain things that we didn't do well as a startup. I remember we're doing a money raising thing in Denmark, and my father had organized it, and we're all out there, and it was at the top of a building. It was a caviar distributor, and he'd got some of his key people to be there for this lunch. Jan shows up late. You get there early for that kind of stuff. And it was things like that, unfortunately. I think I'd only be negative on Jan, because I love him dearly and he was hugely talented. But I think there was a part of him that possibly an ingredient that he missed. But he had the talent, and he justifiably felt upset when we let him go in 98 in the middle of the season, the Canadian Grand Prix. And that was not, things were just beginning to come into place, ironically. But did he have the potential to deliver longer term? And we had to have these question marks. And I wish it had worked out. And I love the fact that Kevin has made it into Formula One, because Kevin was just was born when when Jan was racing with us in Formula 3. So I remember that well. And
interestingly, it was Jos Verstappen who replaced him, and obviously Max now in F1 as well.
Yeah, in the same, exactly. I mean, Max
in the same team.
You know, in the same team that his father was racing in, effectively the same company. Jost drove for half a season for us, and it was good. He did a good job for us, but in the end, we want to go for Johnny for 99. I'm glad we did.
Interestingly for Jan as well, is that that moment could have finished his career. Psychologically, it could have affected him seriously, but he continued and made is still racing today. He's been a Corvette works driver for a long time, and I think it's credit to him that he's still a professional racing driver, whereas others may have broken them in that moment.
Respect for anyone that can have a career that long in motorsports, and his talent is enormous. There's just, he's got something that, you know, gives him an understanding of the car, and you know, I'm sorry that we couldn't, you know, create an environment or work with him close enough to say, look, come on, you need to do this, and this, because it was a huge talent, and in Formula 3 that year, he couldn't get it wrong, you know, and it was just so relaxed. And but you know, maybe it came too easy for him, and he thought, "Well, if I can do that now," and I'm, you know, I've heard, how things were. I was always interested in what happened when he was doing things, and you know, he probably could have worked harder in the gym, and things like that. So I'm sure he would stick his hand up on certain elements, but I'd happily have a beer with him anytime.
I remember one of his management team at the time saying that one of the biggest challenges with Jan was getting him out of the pub and into the gym, and it was very challenging.
Yeah,
I think my wife would say the same thing, to be honest. I've got another question here from Alf Wald, and he says the SF3 was a great car. What are your memories of that crazy race at the Nürburgring when Johnny Herbert got the win?
One of the memories was just being disappointed. Qualified badly. And we were like something like diamond 14th, 15th or something really badly.
Can't recall. Sorry.
It was not a good qualifying that we did. I can't remember what happened, but the car had been a good car all year, and we had led different Grand Prix. We led in Brazil, we led in at the French Grand Prix. So the car clearly was a good car. And we were lucky that race. And it was great to get the win, you know. But, you know, really, at that point, I mean, the most emotional result for me was Monaco 97, without question. That was a really emotional, professional experience that, you know, was very surreal. Winning that race, there was an element of, okay, we were lucky, but we had finished in the podiums that season regularly, or we were regularly scoring points anyway. And then could have scored more if the car hadn't had a problem. So I wouldn't say it was enormously emotional. I remember we left the track. And I remember I'm on the way to the airport. Norbert Haug calls me up, and he goes, "Where are you?" You know, and Norbert was the Mercedes representative, you know, running with McLaren there. And he was all pissed off that I'd left the track. You know, he said, "Get your ass back here. We need, you know, the rest of it." So it was a professional thing. You know, I was ready for the next race. And so I don't know if that answers the question.
No,
but
no,
it was,
it does, absolutely.
It was great. I tell you what, here's another memory from it. You know, we could have got a 1-2 there. And at the time, it was raining, and Rubens came on the radio, and he said, "Shall I come in now?" Now, if I had said, "Come in now," he would have won the race and Johnny would have been second. But it was not protocol for me to override and call in, because if it had gone wrong and I had stuck my neck out, but it would have meant stacking the cars or whatever. It was something anyway, but he had to do an extra lap, and that lost him that time that allowed Trulli to get in front of him. But that's my memory of that race, is Rubens coming on the radio, and then by the time I was going to give him an answer, he was past it.
What did you think of Rubens as a driver? I mean, obviously he's still doing bits and pieces now, but when he was with you, I mean, there was so much kind of excitement about him early on in his career. He's just a really, really fast driver. What are your memories of him driving for you?
Well, I mean, I knew him and I watched him, you know, it was from a Vauxhall, if you like, because we were obviously in the game then with Paul Stewart Racing, so he hadn't raced for us, and he raced against us in, obviously in Formula 3, he was with Dick Bennett's, and Coulthard was his main rival that year. So I was always impressed by his speed and natural talent. My memories of Rubens, and I had a great relationship with Rubens. I really got on well with him, and he needs to be loved. He likes that sort of arm around you, and if there's a problem, Rubens might have got, if you could settle that problem, and it was generally pretty straightforward to settle. You know, he was the next race, you know, would fly. And he came to me at my first proper contact with him was in the Portuguese Grand Prix of 96. And at the time, we were trying to get Damon to come and join the team. And he was poised to win the championship. And I said, if we're serious about this, and the world champion is potential, or the potential world champion is available, we should go for it. And I guess the announcement had been made that he wasn't going to race with Williams or something like that by that point. So we were full throttle trying to get Damon. And then when that didn't work out, at the time I had previous discussions with Rubens, and it was Gary Anderson and Rubens that came to me together. We had a meeting in the Ford motorhome. And Rubens was not in a good state. He wasn't happy with the team. He was flustered. I thought, I can work with Rubens. I know him. I wanted a driver I could look in the eyes and say, you know, and work with him, basically. And he ticked that box, and I really enjoyed my time with him. We still are close. It's a shame he couldn't have won a race for us, because he'd deserve to, because Rubens was really the backbone of the success of from the driving side of Stewart Grand Prix.
Which gave you the greatest satisfaction, standing on a podium yourself or seeing your car on a podium in Formula One?
Seeing the car on the podium in Formula One. I mean, I remember when that race finished, going up to the podium. Everyone runs up to the podium from there, and we were... know where we were, we're other end of the year. We had a bad year in 98, so we're down the other end. It's a long way to run to get the podium. And we had our wet weather gear on, and my father had his wet weather gear on. And there was this sort of moment of, like, who goes up on the podium sort of thing. And I know him well enough, and I looked at him and said, you better take your trousers off, you're going on the podium. You know, better take your wet weather gear off. And that was my sort of gesture to him, if you like, without it becoming a... So I was very proud to see them both up there on the podium, my father up there, and obviously Rubens and Johnny. I felt for Rubens, because, you know, obviously he felt that the win was in his grasp, and it was a great moment, you know.
We're running out of time very quickly, but we have a few more questions I'd like to get in. You were talking about your dad just then. There's a question here from Anthony Jenkins, and he's asking, what is the best characteristic you've inherited from your father, and what is the worst?
I think Simon could answer both.
Merely passing on the message. From Anthony.
I don't know. I'm determined. That's certainly my father, determined. The worst I've got from my father. I can take anything. I'm
saying nothing.
I've taken some qualities from mother too, as well, which who I'm enormously proud of. No, I mean, I don't know. I know I'm full of limitations. I'm a dyslexic. My approach to things is sometimes unorthodox, but there's enthusiasm there, and I found in life that's a key ingredient in making things happen. You know, if you're too clever about stuff, you're going to think about all the problems and convince yourself that something's not possible. Whereas if you're just a little bit blissful ignorant about something, you just go for it, and then you sort the problems out as they come along.
Yeah. Well, there's a question here from Jamie Smith, who's asked a few, but there's one about Francois Severt. He's a huge Francois fan, and he'd love to hear any memories that you may have of him. Obviously, you were extremely young when he died, but did he leave an impression on a young Paul Stewart?
Well, the biggest impression Francois left on me, I mean, it was always his presence was firmly felt in our family because I knew how close my parents were to him. But unfortunately, my best memory of him is being when he got killed. And because I remember, well, I was 7 years old and we were staying at some friend's house because my parents obviously were at the Canadian Grand Prix. I was staying at some friend's house and then boarding at the school during the week. And the TV news came on and it said that Jackie Stewart and Francois Severt encountered death at Watkins Glen today. So here I was being telling, you know, that my father had died. And I, as far as I'm concerned, my father was dead, you know, and I was trying to rationalize this not can't be possible, you know, not, I mean, Joe Bonnier's kids I used to go to school with, they had, his dad, York, and all these things. I thought, and they had said, actually, Joe Bonnier's kids, and they remember on the bus one day going to school, they said, your dad's going to be next, because their dad just died, so they figured, well, it's obvious. So I thought, here, you know, it is now time. And then I was told after that, actually, they got clarification, because he obviously didn't have mobile phones and everything else and internet, and it was Francois that had died and not my father. So there was an element of relief, sadly, but I remember it very, very well, and it marked my, you know, it was an important sort of ingredient in my growing up.
Blimey.
Sorry about that, guys.
No, so it's an experience that, you know, no one would ever want to have to go through.
But I guess a positive one of Francois. I mean, I, you know, my father has great stories about him, but, you know, there's one picture in one of the scrapbooks at my parents' home, and it's him showing up for the Paris Motor Show with a fur coat on. And it was obviously for an early morning appearance, and it was he was scared. He arrived there, and he brought Brigitte Bardot with him, and no one knew that he was with Brigitte Bardot. And he arrived for an early morning appearance. Generally suggests he didn't pick her up on the way there. And this glamorous Frenchman who was, you know, good looking and with Bardot, and he was an extraordinary man, and had a really good impact on our family.
God, we think Lewis is Hollywood at the moment, but is there anything is there anything cooler than turning up in a fur coat to the French Grand Prix with Brigitte Bardot?
Yeah. Now I've just got time for sort of another couple of questions. This is another one from Jamie, actually, who has a real soft spot for Stewart Grand Prix, a startup team done properly and achieved great success in its short lifespan. He wants to know: was it a wrench to sell to Ford, or did you view it as somewhat of a relief? The pressure to get it right and then maintain a high level of competitiveness must have been enormous.
You know, we would never set the company up for sale. I thought, you know, if it ever was going to be for sale, it would be a going sort of concern with different arms to it that were, you know, that were working with manufacturers or whatever they're doing. And, you know, I saw sort of like 18, 20 year horizon sort of thing. And when Ford said to us, look, we want to have our own Formula One team, we want to do the Jaguar thing, et cetera, we want to buy it out. You know, we could have gone and said, no, we're not doing it, but they would have gone elsewhere. And without a manufacturer in Formula One, it's a completely different story because you can't attract the sponsors and everything else. So in the same way, I wouldn't say it was a relief when we sold it, but, you know, financially, it created opportunities that I'd never expected at that early stage of my young professional life. So there were pluses in that, but that wasn't, you know, I guess I was worried that if we had not sold to them, we'd have been in this huge dilemma of how do we keep banks like HSBC and our big sponsors who wanted to be with a manufacturer like a Ford backing it all up. And I think probably the other thing was, you know, if in hindsight it happened in the perfect time because I got, you know, I managed the transition but I was unknowingly, you know, I developed cancer by then. So any regrets I had when I was told I had to have cancer to go through the chemotherapy thing, and that was in 2000, you know, Imola, first European race, you know, it all sort of like, oh, thank God for that. You know, that's good timing because I can concentrate my treatment and hopefully getting better and getting out of it.
Just on a related question, what do you make of the fact that the Ford Motor Company big global automotive institution, kept the team for five seasons and had a couple of podiums, but never really made fantastic progress. And then a fizzy drinks company comes in, takes over that team, and within five seasons has turned it into a race winner and a title challenger, and as we subsequently saw, a multiple champion.
Well, I think when we entered Formula One, what Red Bull are doing now was what we, that was our ambition. I mean, we were only doing it to win. And I think financial circumstances changed, priorities for Ford. I think maybe, you know, they were trying to do it maybe in a more economical way than, say, Mercedes and so on were doing it, and other manufacturers that were sort of committed to it. And I think that, you know, I'm not saying, you know, it was just Ford, because, I mean, we could have done more if we had bigger sponsors as well. So it's just having that sort of, you know, not to say unlimited budget, but what do you need to operate, and then let's do it. And I think we could have done that had we had all that, but we were, you know, I don't know if I answered your question, Simon, but I mean, I'm not putting blame at anyone's feet, but I think certainly Ford, I did get a letter of apology from somebody senior in Ford, and the way it had been handled, and I appreciated that, because an acknowledgement that they underestimated what we had done, and I thought that from a big manufacturer was nice, and I have a huge respect for the company, but I think they probably maybe had the big company syndrome, and maybe we behaved in a certain way that got their backs up on things. Maybe they didn't like tartan or something, I don't know. But but in at the end, I think they realized, well, actually, bloody hell, this was a good job, and you need to be hands-on to run a team like that, and that was not the way they were going to do it.
Well, I think a very fitting note to end on. Paul, thank you so much for joining us. I hope you enjoy your lunch with Andrew coming up now. Sorry, you've had a double whammy of talking about your career. So I'm sure it'll be a delicious lunch, but thank you so much for joining us. Nick, thank you very much for joining us, and Simon. And as always, thank you so much to Alan for making us all sound better than we are in real life. We'll see you all in a couple of weeks for another Motorsport Magazine podcast in association with Mercedes-Benz. Bye-bye for now.
What do you think of when someone says the word used? Old-fashioned? Out of tune? A bit scratched? Something past its best. Chances are you're not thinking of a Mercedes-Benz. And certainly not one of the latest models. Think Mercedes-Benz approved used. Suddenly, there's a lot more meaning to that little word. Visit your local retailer to find your used car today, and you'll see what I mean. I like the way you work it. Mercedes-Benz approved used. Used, but not what you're used to.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads. Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.